It's not complicated to avoid patent infringement, but even federal agencies sometimes do it, and even when they help the company that developed the patent and technology. In the case of Liberty Ammunition and the lead-free bullet, the government learned an expensive lesson. Joining us with a cautionary tale in this week's Legal Loop, procurement attorney Joseph Petrillo, a partner at the law firm Petrillo & Powell. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
All right, so tell us the basic facts here in the Liberty Ammunition case. This is a fairly recent case.
Sure. The Department of Defense was seeking to find a lead-free alternative to the ammunition. It's standard ammunition, 5.56 and 7.62 NATO rounds. They looked at a variety of different possible solutions to that problem, and the best solution seemed to come from a little company called Liberty Ammunition. Liberty was, had extensive efforts to get its design adopted by DOD, and in an earlier stage, they handed over some sample ammunition and some data, and asked three folks in the Army, including a lieutenant colonel, who is the chief of small arms for the Infantry Directorate of Combat Development, to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which is the standard way you do these things in the private sector. And they did, and they got that information and those rounds, and they tested them. And while this process was ongoing, they also got a patent in that invention, in their method of providing this this round without lead. And lo and behold, time goes on. They do not get a contract. They don't get the opportunity to deal directly with the Army. But the ammunition contractor the Army does select uses a very similar design in its round. And so Liberty comes and sues in the Court of Claims for patent infringement.
So it sounds as if the implication is that the other company that got the ATK, that actually got the contract, either developed this on its own unwittingly violating the patent, or did it somehow get the information from the military about how this bullet was developed?
Liberty believes they got the information from the military, and that's why they sought to not only enforce their patent, but to enforce the non-disclosure agreement. And there's an interesting lesson, I think, for contractors in what happened on the NDA. The Court of Federal Claims held that the NDA was unenforceable because it wasn't signed by anyone who had the authority to bind the U.S. government, and that the people who did have that authority presumably didn't ratify the agreement. In order to bind the government, you've got to make sure there's an authorized official. You can't just assume that from the official's title, and the rules are fairly strict on that. And part of the court's holding was that this fellow, who's the chief of small arms for the Directorate of Combat Development, that binding the government in an NDA wasn't really part of his job description. It makes you wonder who does have that authority or that power.
That was my question, because a contracting officer can bind the government to payment, to the disbursement of funds. But I guess not to an NDA. Do we know who can bind the government to an NDA?
I suspect the best way to go is to get a contracting officer to sign it. But as you point out, the contracting officer might say, this isn't a procurement contract, so I'm not going to sign the NDA. I think we've got a real serious problem without a clear resolution. Until government regulations give this authority to someone, contractors are acting to some extent at their own risk and assuming that government actors are not going to release information disclosed under an NDA.
So Liberty Ammunition did not prevail in the infringement of the non-disclosure, but they did get patent infringement relief.
Yeah, that's right. And there's an interesting way that patent infringement is handled in government contracts and has been for 100 years. If there is an infringement under a government contract, the contractor is authorized by the U.S. government to infringe the contract. And a specific statute says that the government can infringe patents, but when it does so, it must pay reasonable and entire compensation to the patent holder. So what this does is it prevents the patent holder from using the injunctive power it ordinarily would have to stop the infringement. The infringement goes on, but the patent holder gets compensated for the use of the patent. And that is how, you know, what ultimately what happened to Liberty. They were able to get a royalty on these on this ammunition.
And what does the royalty tend to be on something that is used in huge quantities like ammunition?
Well, in this case, the royalty turned out to be a fairly small amount. I think it was between 1 and 2 cents per round. But there were over 1 billion rounds purchased, so it kind of adds up.
I can just hear the gunnery sergeant, you know, saying, "What kind of bullets you got? ATKs? Hold your fire. Those of you with Liberty, keep firing." I don't know what would happen if it gets down to that level. But they also got a cash settlement plus interest, too, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is one of the few areas where the government does pay interest on the amount it owes. I mean, there are some other situations where that happens. But here, delay in payment is considered part of compensating the contractor.
And so let's get back to the real key legal issue here, then, is the whole idea of non-disclosure and who can bind the government to that, because this was, as you say, not an acquisition contract originally to develop the bullet. It was a small business innovation research contract, an SBIR.
Well, they did get an SBIR at one point, but the disclosures that they were seeking to enforce happened even before the SBIR, and that's what makes this more complicated. If it was disclosed under the SBIR, then you'd have a claim under that contract, and you'd be able to prosecute that under the Contract Disputes Act and in the ordinary way that these things are handled in government contracts.
And just as an aside, I did a little research on this particular bullet. It's very lightweight, so it has great muzzle velocity, which people that know these things say is a good thing. And it has a way of opening upon contact such that it cuts a bigger hole through whatever it's passing through than it would have otherwise, and so that makes it more lethal.
Yeah, there's a very good technical discussion in the opinion as to why this design was superior to the other ones that were around, and apparently making a good bullet is not a simple matter.
No, I'm surprised. Yeah, I've looked into this a little bit over the years, and it's amazing how much technological and engineering research goes into something that you thought was figured out, 80 years ago, but I guess not. We're speaking with Joe Petrillo. He's a partner at the law firm Petrillo & Powell. And while we have you, Joe, there's another case, unrelated, that seems to have a lot of effect on whistleblowers, and that is attorney-client privilege and when it really exists in the case of a whistleblower seeking documents.
Yeah, it's an interesting case coming out of a QI-TAM action against KBR. In a QI-TAM action, a whistleblower who usually is an employee of the, or an ex-employee rather, of the company, brings suit on behalf of the government saying that the company defrauded the government, in this case Kellogg Brown and Root. And Kellogg Brown and Root is defending the case, and in the course of the case, the whistleblower seeks to get discovery of an internal investigation that KBR did about the topic of the suit. And KBR opposes that on the ground of attorney-client privilege. The trial court judge says to disclose the report, and KBR appeals to the Court of Appeals in D.C. and wins there. And the question is, under what circumstances does an internal investigation keep attorney-client privilege? And in this instance, the court resolved a kind of an interesting issue, which is, why was the report created in the first place? The plaintiff said, well, it was created because various government requirements and contract clauses and regulations require the contractor to investigate this sort of thing. And since it was a requirement and the contractor was meeting that requirement, the investigation wasn't done for the purpose of getting legal advice. And therefore, it's not subject to the attorney-client privilege. KBR defended successfully by saying that it didn't have to be solely for the purpose of the investigation wasn't solely for the purpose of meeting these requirements. It was also done in order to obtain legal advice on what the company should do about the situation. And the Court of Appeals signed it with KBR. And they said that the test, which is what's the primary purpose of the report, doesn't mean it has to be a single primary purpose. There can be multiple purposes, and as long as legal advice is one of the significant purposes, then the report is subject to the attorney-client privilege.
And can does this also extend to whether the company is using in-house counsel versus external counsel?
Well, that was an issue, and that really didn't matter because it's well established that it doesn't. You know, that doesn't affect the attachment of the privilege. In-house counsel are still attorneys, and their activities are subject to attorney-client privilege to the same degree that an outside counsel's activities would be.
All right, so the takeaway is that whistleblowers then cannot assume they can get documents related to something the company is investigating that they, the whistleblower, is also calling them out on.
Right, and from the company's point of view, you know, they can engage in a complete and searching inquiry, and the people engaged in that inquiry can be wholly candid without worries that the document is necessarily going to get disclosed down the road in a QI-TAM case.
All right. Well, I guess maybe it'll help in some sense if at least the whistleblower gets the company to look at it at all. Maybe that's progress.
Well, that's true. And then the next fight comes, you know, when the government tries to get the contractor to disclose this document, these reports, as part, for example, of a debarment or suspension case. And that's a whole other separate question, which we'll have to talk about some other time.
All right. Joe Petrillo is a partner with the law firm Petrillo and Powell. As always, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.